And that leaves just one more chapter for this unit, which makes sense because we're less than a week away from exam two, right? The third chapter in this unit is it takes a closer look at membrane. Not only the structures, the structure that makes up membranes, but also the function of membranes. And some of this should be review at this point because we've talked about a lot of this stuff, including what's really shown in slide one here. What do we call this overall structure that's shown in this picture? Right, this is a phospholipid bilayer, or it's part of one, because it's two monolayers of phospholipids. Each monolayer is arranged so that the tails of that monolayer are pointing toward the tails of the other monolayer. But that phospholipid bilayer forms naturally, I mean automatically, not because of any life, right? Well, I've said this before. What is it about phospholipids that allows this to happen? Right. The fact that phospholipids individually are amphipathic molecules. And what does amphipathic mean? They have a polar place on the same molecule, a nonpolar place. So what is the nonpolar place on a phospholipid? The tails. Why are they nonpolar? Because they are almost hydrocarbons, right? The only thing that keeps them from being truly hydrocarbons is that there's oxygen at the one end where it's connected to the glycerol that's in this head. The gray head contains a glycerol. But the tail, the length of the tails are all carbons and hydrogens. Why does that make them nonpolar?
There's not much difference.
That's right. Carbon and hydrogen have about the same values for electronegativity, and therefore what? Why does that make them polar? Exactly. In other words, the sharing is equal. So there isn't one end of the bond, the CH bond, that is partially negative or partially positive. It's the electrons are equally at both ends. The head of a phospholipid, and we're looking at two phospholipids in detail here on the right. The head is the polar region. What is it that makes the head polar? Well, let's back up a minute then. What makes a phospholipid different from a fat? What's another name for a fat? Well, no, not exactly. Fats are lipids, but there are plenty of lipids that aren't fats. So the two are not interchangeable. I'm talking about another name for fat that's just another name. It's an interchangeable term. Triglyceride or triacyl glycerol. Triglyceride tells you, though, that there's three fatty acids, right? And they are connected to a glycerol. In a phospholipid, there's only two fatty acids. So what else is connected to the glycerol? Instead of a third fatty acid, you have what connected to it? Yes, that's why they're called phospholipids. You have a phosphate group occupying that third connection point on the glycerol. That's why they're not entirely nonpolar like fats are. Instead, they are partially polar at the two fatty acid tails and partially nonpolar at the fatty acid tails and partially polar at the phosphate-containing head. Why is it that phosphate makes it polar? Well, yes, not only does it have oxygen, but it has ionized oxygen, so it's actually even beyond polar. So the gray head here is hydrophilic. Always equate in your mind hydrophilic and polar. Water is a polar molecule. Polar molecules like to be around fellow polar molecules. That's why the hydrophilic word makes sense. Hydrophilic means that they love water. They like being around water. The tails, though, are hydrophobic. And hydrophobic, you should always equate with nonpolar. Nonpolar things do not like to be around polar things. So hydrocarbons are nonpolar. That's why oil doesn't mix with water. Well, these tails are trying to avoid water. That's the whole reason why, without any living thing's help, a collection of phospholipids will automatically assemble into a phospholipid bilayer. All right, that's how the first cell-like structures formed when, over hundreds of millions of years, these phospholipids were accumulating. They were created by the lightning, like we talked about, and there just became more and more of them until they're so close to each other that they form these sphere-like, cell-like spheres made out of phospholipid bilayer. Well, those phospholipid bilayers are not plasma membranes yet, because a plasma membrane has to have more in it than just phospholipids, as we can see in slide 2. Why is it that a cell can't have just phospholipids in its plasma membrane? What's the problem with that? The phospholipid bilayer forms a boundary. That's what a plasma membrane is, in essence, the boundary between the cell and everything else. And a phospholipid bilayer by itself is a pretty good boundary. Now, it's a boundary that allows certain things through it, but other things cannot get through it. I'm talking about just the phospholipid bilayer. Things that are small and nonpolar have no problem slipping right through it, because they don't mind being around these nonpolar tails, and they're small enough. But things that are either big or polar or both don't easily get through a pure phospholipid bilayer. Well, a lot of the things that cells have to get through the membrane won't easily go through a pure phospholipid bilayer. And so you need other things in there besides just the phospholipids, for that reason and for other reasons. But although there are multiple other things besides phospholipids that make up any cell's plasma membrane, it's one of the categories of things that's very important is proteins of various sorts. These purple things represent proteins that are part of the membrane. These are therefore membrane-bound proteins. They make up part of the membrane. And one of the major jobs, that's not the only job, but one of the major jobs of membrane-bound proteins is to allow things that can't get directly through the phospholipid bilayer to get through the plasma membrane with the help of the protein. Okay, now, another thing I want to say about this figure is that these proteins are held in place, but they are not chemically bonded to each other or to any of the phospholipids. These are individual molecules still. What is it that would hold them in place since they are not chemically bonded to the phospholipids? Any guesses? It has to do with the same reason the bilayer forms. So this just looks like a purple glob to you, but keep in mind it's a polypeptide, right? It's a ribbon. It's one long strand of amino acids, but then it's put into a specific shape. So when you make that necklace and allow it to get into its shape, some of those amino acids are going to be from the polar group, right? They're going to be somewhere in the glob. Some of them are going to be from the nonpolar group. Well, in this case, the nonpolar amino acids are in this region. And they like being around these nonpolar tails. The ends, facing inside and outside the cell, have amino acids that are from the polar group. And they don't want to be around these tails. They like being around the water. So even though they're not connected, they're buoyed in here, more or less. And if you imagine trying to push one of this, push this one that's labeled hydrophobic regions, this whole protein, if you try to push that into the cell, what you're going to do is expose this polar part of the protein to this nonpolar region of the thickness of the membrane. And it's not going to want to do that, right? And if you just let go, then it's going to spring right back into this place where nonpolar matches up with nonpolar and polar matches up with polar. That's what keeps it there. All right, three. A bilayer, of course, is two monolayers. It's two separate layers, tail-to-tail arrangement, as we've been talking about. But if you carefully freeze a real cell's plasma membrane, it's a phospholipid bilayer with proteins in it, that freezing will allow you to separate the two monolayers from each other. And the reason for doing that is to indicate what's shown in this slide, namely that although there's proteins associated with both monolayers, there are more proteins associated with the inner monolayer, the monolayer that's in contact with the intracellular fluid, than there are on the outer layer. That should make sense simply because there's a lot more chemically going on inside the cell than outside the cell. Inside the cell is where metabolism occurs, and some of that metabolism involves proteins that are actually embedded into the membrane. Now, there are plenty of other proteins that are not part of the membrane. They're fully inside the cell. They're doing important stuff in metabolism as well. But it just makes sense that there's more proteins facing inward because there's more going on inside the cell. Now on to four. And what we need to discuss with this picture is what is called the fluid mosaic model of membrane structure. So just in outside of biology, just in everyday life, what is a mosaic? It's a work of art that instead of being paint is made up of individual pieces like stones or tiles, which is kind of like one pixel of the picture, each little stone or piece is, and then they're glued in place to make whatever the image is, like on a wall, for instance. That's a mosaic. Fluid means able to flow, right? So fluid mosaic really describes the plasma membrane well because of what I've told you earlier. The phospholipid bilayer forms for reasons of tails trying to avoid water, but it's still millions of individual phospholipids. They don't become covalently bonded to each other. They are in that position simply for the tails to avoid water. Okay? So that means since they're not connected to each other, they can move around with respect to each other. They can change places with each other. Each monolayer is kind of like a human in a crowd. The cartoon even looks like a human, right? Because it has a head and two legs. So right here we're looking at the edge. But if you look down onto the surface of the cell, you would see all the heads, right? In this crowd. And just like for instance, New Year's Eve in Times Square is a good example of a huge mass of people, right? You see a bunch of heads, but they're not. You look at later, 5 minutes later even, they're not going to all be in the same position. They're able to switch places with each other. That's the fluid mosaic. That's the fluid part of fluid mosaic. The mosaic is because each individual phospholipid is kind of like a tile in the mosaic. They're just not glued to the surface. They're able to move around. And it might surprise you how much movement there is. Notice that lateral movement here, which is what I'm talking about, people within their phospholipids within the same monolayer switching places with each other. That happens about 10 million times per second. So just one example of the fact that cells are continuously changing. Never think of them as being static devices. They're highly dynamic. They're always changing. Notice that you can also have, though, this flip-flop, which is the exchange of a phospholipid in one monolayer for a phospholipid in the other monolayer. That's a lot more rare, only about once per month. And it should make sense that it's rare. Why is it rare? Why is that not nearly as easy as two in the same monolayer switching places with each other?
Like as if they like switch like this, they have to pass through those parts that do not match.
That's exactly right. If you try to get this top one into the bottom layer, you're going to have to, at least for some amount of time, expose that polar head to this nonpolar interior of the thickness. It has to be next to some tails in order to get it into the other monolayer, and it doesn't want to do that. So it doesn't happen very often. But each monolayer is just buzzing because of all this lateral movement. So we use the word fluid to refer to the fact that the membrane is held together. It's intact, but it has a looseness to it because of this fluidity. And it's possible for a membrane to be either too loose or not loose enough, depending on the situation. And what I mean by the situation is largely environmental factors. For instance, when temperatures are colder, that's going to make everything tighter, right? Less loose. Just like when things freeze up. So, in that case, it would benefit the cell if it could adjust the fluidity of its membrane to be a little looser, to get it closer back to normal. On the other hand, if it's too hot, things will get too loose, and it would benefit the cell if it could tighten up the membrane a little bit. Well, cells can do that. Cells can adjust the fluidity of the plasma membrane because, remember, membrane material is always being put into the plasma membrane and always taken up. We talked about this when I talked about membrane material being moved around from one organelle to another. So the phospholipids are not only moving around, but they're not permanently in the plasma membrane. Some of those phospholipids can be taken out and others replacing them. Well, this brings us back to the discussion of fatty acids. Remember, each tail in a phospholipid is a fatty acid. And fatty acids can be classified as either saturated or unsaturated, right? Therefore, phospholipids, just like fats, can be either saturated or unsaturated with respect to their fatty acids. And I've already talked about the fact that if you have an unsaturated fatty acid, that means you have at least one double bond, right? And that forms a bend in it, a kink, which takes up more space. So if a cell wants to make its membrane looser, like in response to cold, it will incorporate more unsaturated fatty acid containing phospholipids into its bilayer, and that will loosen it up. If it wants to tighten it up, it will take those ones out and make it almost all saturated fatty acids. That's true for cells in general. The bottom picture has to do with animal cells in particular, because cholesterol here is an animal product. I told you that other organisms make similar things, but not cholesterol. Like plants make phytosterols, fungi make ergosterols. They're similar, but they're not the same thing. But anyway, in an animal cell, like your cells, one of the many functions of cholesterol, one of the reasons we animals require it, is that it is an important component of the plasma membrane as well. So there's phospholipids, there's proteins of various sorts, there's cholesterol in animals. And cholesterol can fill in little gaps between tails and therefore can affect the fluidity of the membrane as well. Not only does cholesterol affect the fluidity, it also affects the permeability of the membrane to certain ions, whether ions get through or not. So that was the fluid mosaic model, and what we see in 5 is the results of a test designed to see whether that hypothesis, that model is actually correct. What they did in this case was start with 2 cells, one from a mouse, one from a human. Each of these, of course, has proteins embedded in their membrane, but shouldn't surprise you to know that mouse proteins aren't exactly identical to human proteins. They have some that we don't. We have some that they don't. And they aren't actually magenta and purple in real life, of course, but it's important for them in this experiment to be able to keep track of these proteins. So they labeled them in a special experimental way so that they could actually keep track of them. Well, they fused these 2 cells together, which is fairly easy because it's membrane material for both of these. And so you have now a cell that's half human and half mouse, this hybrid cell. And as soon as this happens, of course, that at that very moment, one half of the cell is going to have all the mouse proteins and one half of the cell is going to have all the human proteins, right? Well, if the fluid mosaic model is not true, then those collections of proteins should stay put. You can come back later and still see half of it being mouse-only proteins and the other half human-only proteins. But if the fluid mosaic model is true and all these components of the plasma membrane are moving around with respect to each other, then you would expect to see what they actually did see, which is, after a while, it didn't take very long. The proteins moved all around and you have a collection of both mouse and human proteins all around the cell. So the fluid mosaic model is actually true. Now, 6 is still another cartoon of a plasma membrane, but and you also get another view of these various proteins making up the cytoskeleton, various proteins in the extracellular matrix. We've talked about all that before. But what I want to mention here are some categories of membrane-bound proteins. First of all, a protein is not membrane-bound unless it's connected to a membrane, unless it's part of a membrane. So there's not shown here, but there's plenty of proteins that are fully inside the cell. Those are not membrane-bound proteins. Membrane-bound proteins, though, can be categorized based on how far they extend through the thickness of the membrane. And for instance, here we have a couple that are labeled as peripheral proteins. Peripheral is the adjective of periphery, which just means the edge. Peripheral proteins are membrane-bound proteins, but notice that they are associated with just one monolayer, in this case, the inner monolayer. Peripheral proteins really don't extend into the thickness where the tails are. They're still not held in place by covalent bonds, so they're free to wander around on that inner surface. But that's what makes them peripheral proteins. The other proteins that are bigger are another category. Those are called integral proteins. Integral proteins do extend at least partially into the thickness where the tails are. And integral means they're part of the integrity. They are more part of the actual overall structure of the membrane since they are in there with the tails. They're not just on the edge. Well, unfortunately, this book chose to only show one kind of integral protein. All of this one labeled integral, of course, is integral. All these others that poke all the way through are integral proteins. But an integral protein does not have to stick all the way through the thickness. Only some integral proteins do that. All of them in this example, but it's fairly easy to imagine one of these proteins only poking halfway through, roughly. So they would have a part that is, for instance, in contact with the intracellular fluid, but also in contact with the tails. It just doesn't stick all the way through the thickness. That would still be an integral protein because it's exposed to those tails. Integral proteins that do stick all the way through, like this one that's labeled integral protein, are a subset, a specific kind of integral protein that we call transmembrane proteins. That word just means across the membrane, meaning through the thickness. And these membrane-bound proteins have various jobs that we'll talk about, but like I said a little earlier, one major job is to help things that can't get easily through the phospholipid bilayer to get those things into or out of the cell. Well, that's a good example of a protein that has to be transmembrane, right? If it's going to help something all the way through the thickness to get either into or out of the cell, that protein better extend all the way through the thickness. That's just what transmembrane means, though. Another thing, though, while we're still on this picture, is that notice that there's a bunch of these green carbohydrates. So they're sugars of various sizes. You know, some of them are just oligosaccharides, meaning just a small number of monosaccharides hooked together. Some of them are polysaccharides. But these sugars of various sizes are connected to members of the components of the membrane. Some of them are connected to phospholipids. Glyco means sugar, like in glycosidic linkage. So this is a glycolipid because it's a lipid connected to a sugar. Other sugars are connected to proteins, so those are glycoproteins. The glyco part, the sugar part, though, of these can act like little ID badges, which is really important in a multicellular organism like we are. If you're a single cell, you know what is you, the only cell you have. And anything else is not you. But in a multicellular organism, it's important for the various cells that make up that one organism to recognize each other as part of the same organism and not a potential invader. These sugars can allow other cells to recognize that cell. Seven. Well, this is one ribbon, notice. So this is one polypeptide we're looking at here. And notice the secondary structure. This one features a bunch of alpha helices, which is part of secondary structure, remember? And each of these helices is like one stave or wooden part of a barrel. And all of them together make a hollow tunnel. This is a transmembrane protein that is acting as a little tunnel to allow certain things that can't easily get directly through the phospholipid bilayer to get into or out of the cell. This is what I was talking about earlier. So this is not only a membrane-bound protein, but functionally speaking, this would be classified as a transport protein. Transport proteins are membrane-bound proteins whose job it is to facilitate getting things into or out of cells. The transport that transport protein means in this case is not transport of things from one place in the cell to another. Specifically, that kind of transport that we're looking at being done by this protein, it is better called transmembrane transport. Transmembrane transport means moving something through the membrane, either into or out of the cell. Okay, now, there are six major categories of functions that these membrane-bound proteins perform, and that's what's shown in slide 8. I just talked about transport proteins. That's what's shown in A. And I'll talk more about that in other parts of the slideshow, but transport is one major function of membrane-bound proteins. Enzymatic activity refers to using membrane-bound proteins as catalysts. Enzymatic means involving an enzyme, right? Well, all enzymes are proteins acting as catalysts. Most enzymes are proteins that are not membrane-bound. They're fully inside the cell, acting as catalysts. Well, this one just happens to be also part of the membrane. So it's not really doing its job any differently as a catalyst than it would be if it's fully inside the cell, but this one just happens to be part of the cell itself. And what you see happening here with the arrows is that a substrate is able to come in here and bind to the active site. That causes the reaction to occur and turn it into a product, which then gets released. Okay, in C we have signal transduction. We've talked about chemical signals before, right? They are molecules that, or at least particles, but usually molecules that cause things to happen that wouldn't happen if the signal were not present. But remember the important thing that I told you about signal molecules, which is that they do nothing at all. They have no effect unless they can bind to a receptor that can recognize their shape. Well, transduction, to transduce, which is the verb form, means to change from one form to another. For instance, loudspeakers are examples of transducers because they transduce electrical energy into mechanical energy. The woofers and tweeters move back and forth to push on the air to create sound waves. Well, in signal transduction, what we're talking about is that there isn't just one messenger involved. The signal is kind of like a messenger, carrying a message, delivering it to something. But this signal molecule, whatever it is, this orange sector-shaped thing, that is the original signal, and it's trying to deliver that signal to the cell. Of course, it can't do anything unless it has the right kind of receptor, right? Some signal molecules, though, are able to get through the phospholipid bilayer and enter the cell. Those are, for instance, the steroid hormones. Steroids are lipids. Lipids are nonpolar, and they therefore can slip right through the membrane because the tails don't bother them. But most of the hormones in your body are based on proteins, and they do not get through the membrane. So they have to basically just knock on the door. Here you have a purple protein acting as the receptor. It has just the right shape to receive this signal if the signal is present. But the signal is not entering the cell. Instead, it's just binding to the protein. Well, this is an example of a ligand, right? The signal is an example of a ligand. And what is the general consequence of a ligand binding to a protein? What happens in all cases when a ligand binds to a protein? No guesses even? There is a conformational change in the protein. The protein changes shape when the ligand binds to it. Okay? Well, let's just say this purple thing is an integral protein that only goes halfway through the thickness of the membrane. If the signal is there, it would be received by that receptor, and the receptor would therefore change shape. But the cell would never know that's happening, right? Because there would be no part of this protein that is in direct contact with the interior of the cell. So this, just like a transport protein has to be transmembrane, so does a receptor protein acting for signal transduction. Because what happens here is that the signal doesn't enter the cell, it binds to the exterior placed part of the receptor protein. The receptor protein changes shape, but that includes a shape change to the part of the receptor that's facing the interior of the cell. And so now that new shape can interact with things inside the cell that it couldn't have interacted with before. Meaning that things are going to happen inside the cell that wouldn't happen until the signal is knocking on the door outside. Well, the signal's job is done, but the final result has not happened yet, because now whatever happens next in line is the next messenger, the so-called second messenger, which can cause things to happen. There can be multiple messengers in a row, and eventually something, the ultimate effect is realized, which is what the signal indirectly leads to. Cell-to-cell recognition is just what I was talking about with these ID badges. Here you have a protein. Well, it's a glycoprotein on one cell because it's a protein in the membrane, but it's also connected to sugar. And then a protein in another cell that has the right shape to recognize that sugary ID badge. So these cells are recognizing each other as part of the same organism. Good guys, in other words. Similarly, intercellular joining can involve membrane-bound proteins of two different cells in the same organism. But in this case, it's not about recognizing each other. It's about holding these two together. This is exactly what happens in a desmosome that I talked about earlier. So that's intercellular joining. And then the strain relief I was talking about earlier is F, attachment of to the cytoskeleton and the extracellular matrix. If you tug on this thing, it's not going to just rip apart the plasma membrane, because when you tug indirectly on the protein, it will even more indirectly tug on even more proteins inside the cell, keeping the plasma membrane intact. All right, we have to stop there. Finish it up next time.